This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP, fighting against ageism in the workplace and the marketplace. Find out more at carp.ca.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Zoomer Week in Review, all things Zoomer worldwide. I'm Libby Znaimer.
From another devastating diagnosis to another remarkable recovery.
That is a promo for my own story as we launch the real-time documentary on the novel treatment for my third primary cancer. And a new book tells the history of the dollar-a-year men who volunteered their services to our government during World War II and played a key part in winning the war against Hitler. But first, here are your Zoomer headlines from around the world. The Food and Drug Administration is removing a long-standing warning from hormone-based drugs used to treat menopause symptoms in women. The just-announced change is a break from more than 20 years of FDA policy in which the drugs carried the agency's most severe warning label. The FDA's commissioner and some other doctors have long criticized the current warning labels as outdated and unnecessary, but other experts have said the warning carries important information about the risks of stroke, heart attack, and breast cancer. Nearly one in three Americans may have an undiagnosed iron deficiency, a problem that can lead to fatigue, brain fog, and difficulty concentrating. A new study suggests 14% have low iron blood levels, while 15% had the right iron levels, but their bodies can't use the essential mineral properly. Doctors don't typically screen adults for this, which is why the condition has been overlooked in many people. The biggest risk factor for iron deficiency is being female. A record number of older Americans live alone. 28% of U.S. adults over 65, that's 16 million people, are aging on their own. This unprecedented growth is fueled by living longer, fewer marriages, gray divorces, and a desire to age in place. In 1950, just 9% of all U.S. adults lived by themselves, and the expectation is that in a decade, the majority of people 80 and older, about 10 million, will be solo agers. A German priest was horrified to discover he's the grandson of Heinrich Himmler after recognizing a photograph of the Holocaust architect's mistress as his own grandmother. 49-year-old Heinrich Lenkeit was surfing the internet when he discovered his grandmother, Hedwig Potthast, had an affair with the Nazi politician during the Second World War before giving birth to his mother. His mother never mentioned the connection, and he grew up not knowing that his grandfather wasn't his biological one. Lenkeit says he's having difficulty adjusting his view of his family, even though he says none of them believed in the Nazi ideology. He also remembers thinking it's strange that so few people seem to be mourning his grandmother at her funeral in 1994. The world's oldest living gold medalist, Charles Coste, has died at 101. The French cyclist won Olympic gold in track cycling's team pursuit at the 1948 Olympic Games in London. He returned to the spotlight last year as the second-to-last bearer of the Olympic flame for the 2024 Paris Games. I'm Libby Znaimer, and those are your Zoomer headlines from around the world.
From another devastating diagnosis to another remarkable recovery, follow Zoomer Radio's own Libby Znaimer and her medical team in real time as they navigate treatment for her third primary cancer.
The sequel I never expected was my diagnosis and treatment for stomach cancer in 2023. It was my third primary cancer. We followed the ups and downs in real time in a documentary that launches Monday, November 17th, and I chatted with frequent guest host Christine Ross.
This is your second documentary on your cancer journey, a sequel, if you will. Why did you decide to do it again?
It was different. And the thing that was most interesting when we did the documentary about my pancreatic cancer, where yet again it was a miraculous recovery, we did it in retrospect. This time we had permission and we shot it in real time as it was unfolding. So when you see my husband and I getting results or a test or trying to figure out what to do or having side effects, it's all in real time. We did not know the outcome. And again, it wasn't quite as dire as pancreatic cancer, but a survival rate for stomach cancer is only 30%. My tumor was extremely large and aggressive this time. So we just didn't know how it was going to turn out. And first of all, unbelievable care at Princess Margaret, but it was a fairly new therapy.
When did you first know, though, that something was amiss?
Well, I didn't see. Part of the problem is, so people talk about the new normal, right? So after I had a very major operation for pancreatic cancer called the Whipple, where they took half my stomach, a quarter of my pancreas, a bunch of small bowel. And as a result of that, it was not abnormal for me to have pain, discomfort. It wasn't huge. I mean, I was doing really well, but I didn't recognize when the symptoms got out of control, when, you know, this level of pain is not normal, because I thought it was my new normal. I still have regular CT scans to monitor for spread or anything. And I was having a regular CT scan for pancreatic cancer. And just at the very edge, there was an enlarged node. And I thought, why are they making such a fuss about an enlarged node? But yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the doctor's prognosis and the recovery and what they told you once they discovered this.
They didn't really talk about the prognosis. The issue was, it was a big tumor, and the issue was, were they going to be able to operate on it because of the way it was? And in these things, surgery is considered to be the only cure. And there's also the question of what kind of treatment, like systemic treatment. So that's chemotherapy, immunotherapy, targeted treatments. And so I had had amazing success previously, like drugs are good.
Yeah.
And so there is, and it's a very new treatment, immunotherapy. I'm sure people have heard of it, but it's still just unfolding. It's different drugs for different cancers. Chemotherapy is described as a carpet bomb, where it's your whole system and not just the cancer. That's why people get really sick. Immunotherapy triggers your immune system to fight the cancer. So they gave me a test. There isn't immunotherapy for every cancer, but there is for stomach cancer. So they gave me a test to see if it would work on me, and I scored very high on that test. So I started this immunotherapy. And at first it was just fine, like no side effects. It was working clearly, though not necessarily enough to shrink the tumor enough. And I thought, I had had a very difficult recovery after the last surgery, and I thought, I don't want to have my stomach removed. I think it's going to be hellish. I love to eat. I love to cook. And maybe I'll just stay on immunotherapy. I know of people who stay on it literally for years, though it ultimately does stop working. It triggers your immune system. So anything can happen, and not just like 3 days after. And I still have things that happen. So I did have some very bad side effects.
Aside from the physical impact of your cancer, there's a huge emotional component to it. How did you deal with that?
Well, it was our third time, and I'm sort of, I have to, like, my husband is amazing, Doug Gould, and he's been with me through all of this, and, it takes up an awful lot of his time, or especially when I was in treatment, he was with me at everything, and we're both pretty practical and hard-headed, and you just kind of do what you have to do. And my advice for people is, when you're in this, like, don't look too far ahead and don't look too far back. And, you know, I think in our culture in general, it's very hard to be in the moment. And that is kind of what you have to do. Like, you just concentrate on, what do I have to deal with today? And what's the next thing? And don't stray from that. And you kind of, you get used to things, like even a bad situation, you get used to it.
And how are you feeling today?
I feel generally pretty good. Like I said, there are some actually quite recent side effects from having my stomach completely removed that I wasn't really prepared for. It's like blood sugar, hypoglycemia, like that kind of stuff. But I have a completely normal life. I do all my activities.
You play tennis.
I play tennis. I work full time. I try to get to my other exercises. It's all good. It's amazing.
But speaking of that, I mean, you and I share a love of cooking. You play tennis. Are those things that kind of help you refocus and just find the joys in the simple things?
Yeah. And also coming to work, because, you know, when you're being treated for cancer, you can't control all of that. But work, a job I've been doing for a very long time.
And that you love.
And that I love. You know, that's in my control. And I keep thinking, you know, everybody's different. And some people, when they're diagnosed, they stop everything and they just focus on this. And I'm thinking, I didn't know what the outcome's going to be. There has to be more to life than just dealing with my cancer.
But there must have been tough days at work when you were dealing with the side effects.
Absolutely. And I have to thank everybody here, including you, Chris, because they made it possible for me to work through, because there were days when I couldn't. Mm-hmm. I was just about the only on-air person. I got a whole rig for a studio at home when I was recovering from surgery so I could do that, even though I much prefer to come into work. So everybody here, and especially Moses, my brother, who runs the joint, made it possible for me to work, which for me was like a sane lifesaver.
Tell me the name of the documentary and when people and where people can see it.
Well, the documentary is the sequel, I Never Expected. It will launch Monday, November 17th, 9 p.m., Vision TV.
And what do you hope people will take from it?
I think it'll show just the uncertainty of how a cancer diagnosis and treatment unfolds. The other thing is, it was amazing, so fortunate to be here in Toronto. Princess Margaret is the cancer center, but it's part of the University Health Network. And as I started to experience these side effects, like, it really showcases the collaboration, because something would happen and then suddenly I'd be at Toronto Western or at Toronto General seeing somebody else. And I've got to hand it to the doctors. I mean, this was unfolding. But it was also interesting for them because they haven't seen thousands of these things.
Libby, thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Chris. My documentary, The Sequel I Never Expected, launches Monday, November 17th at 9 p.m. on Vision TV. I'm Libby Znaimer, and this is the Zoomer Week in Review. Coming up, the Canadian dollar a year men who built a munitions industry from almost nothing to help us defeat Hitler and win the Second World War.
You're listening to the Zoomer Week in Review, brought to you by CARP. fighting for financial security for our seniors. Find out more at carp.ca.
It's a fascinating new take on an important story from our recent past. The dollar-a-year men in Canada during the Second World War were business and professional leaders who volunteered their services to the federal government and turned us into a military powerhouse instrumental in winning the war. I talked with author Alan Levine.
It's actually an amazing story that most people really don't know much about. I mean, if you think about it, you know, Canada in 1938-39, when World War II started, was a country of 11 million people or so, small, still stuck in the Depression or just coming out of it, did not have much in the way of any kind of aircraft manufacturing, ships, warships, certainly not. That country had never built a proper machine gun, a tank, anything like that. And within about 5 years, mainly because of the impetus of these businessmen and the leadership they provided, you know, Canada was like the fourth largest military power in the world, at least for a little while.
Something like that is almost unthinkable today, that singularity of purpose. So how did it come to be?
It is. I mean, there's a number of factors. One, I think these businessmen the dollar a year man name is a bit of a misnomer. They actually weren't paid a dollar a year, even though that's what they were referred to during the war. I actually found a report that out of, let's say, the 250 people who worked for munitions supply, one guy actually really did get a dollar. And in a couple other ways, some of them also did. Most of them got their expenses covered by Ottawa, and they were paid by their companies. The government, I think, why did they rely on businessmen, let's say, and not bureaucrats to do this is a good question. I think there was a bit of a scandal in the late 1930s involving a contract for the Bren gun. It was a light machine gun. And they, at the time, just before the war, the contract was given without any competing bids. And this created, in typical Canadian fashion, a scandal. Out of this came a lot of negative press, and there was no corruption, let's say, but some kind of incompetence. So a report was done, a royal commission was called for. One of the things that the commission recommended was that a defense purchasing board be established, in which there would be responsible businessmen and accountants in charge. That was the beginning of this process that led to something called the War Supply Board, and then in April 1940, C.D. Howe, who was the only businessman in the cabinet, being appointed the minister in charge of this munitions and supply. And Howe, and as well as his Leighton Ralston, who was the finance minister for a while before becoming the defense minister, both believed that business people were the only people that could lead these departments. So I don't write, obviously, about 250 people. The book itself is concerned with the leaders. There were these guys ran like about 17 production branches, including aircraft, which was huge. A guy named Ralph Bell from Nova Scotia, who had no experience, really.
I was going to ask about that. Yes. He was an amateur pilot.
Exactly.
And when C.D. Howe first said, I want you to run this, he said, I fly planes. Exactly. I don't know how to build them.
Exactly.
How did he figure out how to do this?
Well, he was a smart entrepreneur, a nasty guy, actually, by any standard. He later was involved in the fisheries industry, and not many people didn't have a lot good to say about him, but he was a big philanthropist, and he gave a lot of money to Mount Allison University. I don't know. You know, he figured it out along the way. His leadership skills, he got the right people. He had the backing of Howe, although Howe and Bell, you know, clashed. Howe was a difficult, a brusque person, let's say. Bell didn't like being told what to do. That was the other thing. You know, these guys, a lot of them were, they had big egos. They had worked in a sort of a pyramid structure in which they were on top, and they had to it wasn't bureaucratic necessarily, but they had to answer to Howe at least. So At one point, they decided to create a crown corporation called Federal Aircraft that would sort of oversee all these other private companies building the planes. Bell was then made, not only was in charge of aircraft production, but he was made the CEO of this crown corporation called Federal that was based in Montreal. After a while, it became evident that he couldn't do both. So Howe, without telling him, hired just decided that this guy named Ray Lawton, who was later the Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, was a printer in London, Ontario. For whatever reason, I couldn't determine the actual fact that Howe liked him, decided that Ray Lawton would be head of this Federal Aircraft. And he did so. He appointed the guy without even talking to Ralph Bell about it. Well, you can imagine Bell wasn't happy, and Ray Lawton and Ralph Bell fought in private and in public for about a year or two until Ray Lawton eventually left. But
this is unthinkable today when we really do need to pull together and create new industries, because the ones we've got are certainly under threat. And, you know, you say that there was criticism, but there was still a sense of purpose now.
Sure. The world is obviously much more complicated. You know, when a businessman is, no company would pay a businessman to live in Ottawa for 5 years and keep paying their salary. I mean, it just wouldn't happen. I mean, these guys were loyal to Britain. They were very patriotic. Not that people aren't today, but I mean, it has come to my attention that Prime Minister Carney recently created something called the Defense Investment Agency, that's overseen by one of his cabinet ministers. And they picked this guy, Doug Guzman, who was a former deputy chair of RBC, and he also was a managing director of Goldman Sachs. But he's going to be in charge of looking after procurements for the Defense Department for like over $100 million, which is a massive amount of money, obviously. But he, you know, he's getting a salary. He's not volunteering his service. So, I mean, he'd be the modern day, I guess, kind of. And there's other business people involved in government. I mean, if anybody... Carney has a business background, so I can see him bringing in his chief of staff and the head of the Privy Council are all business people. So there obviously is a role for business people to play, but something like this is just not, I can't see it being emulated again in that sense.
What can we learn from this that might be useful?
Well, I mean, I think that in serious times, and Canada was in danger, good people came forward. And that's an important lesson and a legacy that they left. And many of them were very humble. They didn't necessarily write about it or talk about it a lot. Some of them wrote memoirs, but they didn't. You know, their grandkids that I did talk to, some of their grandchildren, some of these guys. And, you know, they didn't really brag about it or what they did. They just sort of went on with their lives. And, you know, and it showed there was certainly a room for business. I mean, once the war ended, Howe continued until he was defeated in 1957. He kept relying on businessmen in the 40s and 50s. I think the last real dollar a year man probably was like 1954. So a good 10 years almost after the war ended, he was still recruiting these guys to come to Ottawa, maybe paying them a salary. They weren't being paid by their own companies like during the war. But I mean, I think there's, you know, it's an honorable lesson and an important part of Canada's history.
Okay. Alan Levine, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Alan Levine, author of The Dollar a Year Men, How the Best Business Brains in Canada Helped to Win the Second World War. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the Zoomer Week in Review. I'm Libby Znaimer. Thanks for joining me today. Be sure to come back next week to stay up to date with all things Zoomer worldwide.
Zoomer Week in Review is produced by Zeev Hadi and Christine Ross, with technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Znaimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.